stand?
So I'm going to welcome people, get things started, and I turn it over to Guard Gordon.
And remember what we talked about back to Calvary is
just yep, totally.
You cats ready?
That's us.
He knows me.
Good morning. I was about to say good afternoon. Good morning. We are in workshop 213, A Way Out of No Way. This is being recorded, so if at any point you are invited to participate, please use the microphone that is on the floor, way back there. And I remind you, flip the bit, switch, buttons, silence, please. Avoid social shame. My name is Kate Walker, and I have the privilege of serving as the president of the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society. We are co-sponsoring this workshop, and we will hear more about our Living Legacy co-sponsor from our speakers. So welcome. We are very, very delighted that you are here with us this morning. And I want to share just a little bit of information about, if you will, the UUHHS, as we say, the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society. It's been in existence, believe it or not, in various forms with various names since 1934. I thought it was older. 1834. Yeah, 1834. The mission of the society is to strengthen a community dedicated to the disciplined study of liberal religious history, and to advance education, research, dissemination of our Unitarian Universalist heritage, and beyond the Unitarian Universalist Association. We seek to increase awareness of our traditions and their diverse experiences and expressions in which region, race, class, gender, and generation are a part. And to this end, we promote the collection and preservation of historical materials, support research by academic and independent scholars, including those in Unitarian Universalist theological schools, disseminate the fruits of that scholarship through various media, including the Society's journal. This is our latest issue of our highly esteemed journal, and as well as broad public and engaging congregations in historical research and celebrating our heritage. And I am very delighted that this past year we also entered into 21st century social media. Let me tell you, it is not easy getting historians to embrace social media. But we have done it. We are on Facebook, and we tweet. Yes, I know. It's just a revelation, absolute revelation. And we have a brand new website. So what else can I tell you real quick? We're very proud of our journal. We also have a newsletter, which comes out a couple times a year. You can get it electronically, as well as in the snail mail, if that's your preference. We sponsor an annual lecture called the Conrad Wright Lecture that's held in rotating locations across the country. Every 3 years, we have a history and heritage conference we call History Convo that we sponsor with Collegium in the fall of 2016. It's in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So watch our website we're about to choose the date in the Minneapolis-St. Paul, fall of 2016. We sponsor workshops such as this, so I want to draw your attention this afternoon at 4:15. We are sponsoring a workshop with Cynthia Grant Tucker. checks out, which we're really delighted for. And of course, as I said, brand new website. We also have a listserv where you can debate with other historians. We have UU Biography. This is a really great resource. If you want to know more about a UU historian, we have a biography, electronic. Or you plug in the name, you find out everything you need to know about that person. And if there isn't anything there and you want to do research at that person, you can then submit your findings to help fill out our biography. We have all sorts of archives. We publish books, Introduction to Unitarian Universalist Traditions, Andrea Greenwood, Mark Harris, co-author over here. A couple examples, Universalist Unitarian Women Ministers. This one you can get at our booth for free. So let me draw your attention to our booth, where you can get other free publications, and more importantly, I know you all want to join now. You can join our society and support history. I'll leave those there. Now, I do have two quick, exciting things that we're very proud to announce. Every year we present awards to people doing outstanding work in history and heritage. And this year, we just announced the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society, delighted that the winner of this year's Heritage Prizes, the Seminarian Prize. The Seminarian Prize goes to Dana Capasso for her essay, The Life of the Reverend Myla Frances Tupper Maynard, a deeply researched study of a previously little-known pioneer of women's ministry. And the second, the winner of the Religious Education Prize is Mark Morrison Reed for the Companion Guide to the Selma Awakening. This is a deep and challenging adult education curriculum that invites participants to research their own congregation's Selma stories, thus broaden our understanding on one of the most important events in 20th century Unitarian Universalist history. Now, both of these recipients will get a cash award as well as, well, free membership in our society. And in 2016, next year, we will be offering an award, and this is where it might catch your attention here, for a congregational history project. So if you have an interest in looking at your own congregational history, we have resources on our website on how to do that, and then you could submit your work for an award. So we haven't done that since 2012, because we like to shake things up a little bit. Now, I know you didn't come to hear me. You came to hear these people, which is fabulous. So I'm going to introduce a dear friend and someone I admire a great deal, and that's the Reverend Dr. Gordon Gibson. He sent me a long resume. If you want to see it printed out, I'd be happy to share it, but this man has been so busy, just so busy in his long, long life. So some of the most important things. He served for many different churches, finally ending his long career at the UU Fellowship of Elkhart, Indiana. And he has served in other employment as well, but he's been a minister since 1964. And one of the things that I found wonderful is that at one point he was the only Unitarian Universalist minister serving in the state of Mississippi between 1969 and 1984. Wow. Talk about being in leadership. He also is my predecessor as the president of the Unitarian Universalist Historical Society. So thank you very much. And one of the founders and leaders in the Living Legacy Project, which he will share with you as well. And he has many research interests, including on one of his published books, Southern Whites, Unitarian Universalists in the Civil Rights Era, available from Skinner House at the bookstall.
Yes.
At the bookstore. So walk, don't run, to get your copy. Is there a book signing?
Immediately following this workshop, we are descending to the display area, and Southern Witness, actually co-published by Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage. Mm-hmm. Be happy to sign your copy.
So, yes. You get immediate gratification. So, a couple stories, real quick. He did note that in 1965, he served, was arrested at a demonstration and served 7 days of a 5-day jail sentence. And he is maybe in retirement, but that doesn't mean he's not busy. And including all sorts of city activities in Elkhart. He is Human Relations Committee, working with the NAACP branch. And of course, some of you may have enjoyed him on the civil rights tours that he'd been doing in 2006 and 2008. Ladies and gentlemen, Gordon Gibson.
Many thanks, Kate. We worked together to effect a merger of the Unitarian Universalist Women's Heritage Society and the Unitarian Universalist History Society. And Kate has gotten to preside over the new dynamism of those merged organizations. In a few minutes, you will also get to hear from Reverend Dr. Hope Johnson, who has been the leader of the Living Legacy Project since it began. And that's an important entity that you can learn some more about today. And the Reverend David Carl Olson, serving First Unitarian Church in Baltimore, who has had all too much experience in contemporary application of understandings of how you work in a socially dynamic and challenging situation. I want us to think of this workshop in terms of an Ashanti term, Sankofa. Sankofa. I've been pronouncing it Sankofa, and I used that term, and someone I was just getting to know said, no, no, it's Sankofa, emphasis on the first syllable. Albert Ba said, you know, I come from Ghana, it's Sankofa, and our meaning for Sankofa is looking back, doing the history, looking back in order to move forward intelligently with information, and I would hope also with inspiration. Southern Witness looks at the Deep South states, essentially the old Confederacy, in the civil rights era, the 1950s, 1960s, and actually reaching back a little bit into the 1940s. That was a socially dynamic time in the South because lots of Southern boys, Southern families had been shipped out into the world. Southerners volunteer a lot for the military. So these people from cities, towns, small towns, villages, farms across the South were shipped out to all sorts of exotic places around the world in the course of World War II. And for those of African heritage, they found often they were treated differently abroad than they were at home. They came home with changed expectations. Well, the South has not always been a welcomer of changed expectations. The white South has had a tendency, when asked to change, to say, no way. What was also happening in that time was that Unitarianism, and to a lesser extent, universalism. We're rediscovering that area. Basically, Unitarianism had ignored the South. Actively ignored. Not very interesting, not our kind of people. And that changed. That changed with the development within Unitarianism of the fellowship movement, the idea that there might be a congregation. Lay led. Turn lay people loose on their own? Scary. But very democratic and pretty dynamic. And Unitarian fellowships and one or two Universalist fellowships began emerging in the Deep South with the kind of sensibility that we people have that's human dignity, democratic process, justice, love, what was in that era called brotherhood, which we thought was a very inclusive term then. Sorry, sisters. Those pioneering Unitarians and new Universalists encountered a Southern reaction that new ideas coming in, new social forms, no way. And those Unitarians and Universalists had to find ways to say, way, yes, we can do this. Some interesting dynamics there. And so, those Southern Unitarians and Universalists, many of the existing Universalist congregations were very small, they were family-sized congregations, they were located in rural areas. They really are not a major part of this story. There was a Universalist-affiliated fellowship in Athens, Georgia. It was very much part of the story. So mostly it was Unitarians in the early years, and then 1961 on, Unitarian Universalists. But our Southern Unitarian Universalists were living in intimate relationship with Southern social problems. It wasn't something abstract that they read about in the newspaper. It was something that was in their town, in their city, in their family. The civil rights movement, which was one of the dynamic forces attempting to reshape Southern society, the preeminent force reshaping that Southern society, was overwhelmingly populated by Black Americans and was totally led by Black Americans. Predominantly white Unitarian Universalists learned how to follow, how to support, how to enter into aspects of that movement. So Southern Unitarian Universalists had to find a way to confront the no way of Southern society. Sometimes it got rough. Sometimes it got rough. For example, Do we have anybody in here who has ever served as a church secretary or administrator, administrative assistant? Okay, could you step to the microphone back here? Yeah. Real life situation. Real life situation. Your church secretary of the Unitarian Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Once again, church phone rings. You pick it up. The voice on the other end of the line delivers unto you yet another threat to bomb the church. Your response?
My response as a 2015 administrator, or my response of what I would think of as being in that situation and having lived in that situation.
Well, why don't we try both? See what we've learned in 2015. Let's start out back in the, say, early 1960s.
In the early 1960s, I probably would have hung up the phone and gone to the minister and told him what happened. I imagine we would call the police and leave the building.
Okay. And in 2015?
In 2015, I think I would ask the person if there was something I could do to help him.
We have learned.
Okay.
Eve Girard...
Sit down.
Yes, you may. Yes, you may. Thank you very much. Good church administrator. Eve Girard came up with one of the classic one-liners. You'll have to take your turn. There are several people ahead of you. Probably not the wisest response because it might have egged them on, but after a certain point, just, oh, the heck with it. Sometimes it was more serious than that. In Jackson, Mississippi, Don Thompson served the Jackson, Mississippi congregation and some of the other smaller, even smaller, Mississippi congregations, starting in 1963. Don went to Mississippi knowing, okay, it's a tense atmosphere, you know, keep sort of a low profile on contentious issues. He was planning to do some pastoral care at the nearby state mental hospital and sort of leave it at that. But He was asked, please, there's a vacancy on the board of the Mississippi Council on Human Relations. Would you be willing to serve on that board? Well, human relations doesn't sound controversial. However, the Mississippi Council on Human Relations in 1963 was the only biracial organization in the state, had a mailing list of several thousand names, sent out newsletters encouraging conversation across those racial lines, which would, in the eyes of the Mississippi establishment, clearly indicate its communist leanings. Don probably underestimated that. Anyhow, he agreed to fill that vacancy on the board. And he got to his first board meeting. Oh, our secretary has resigned. Would you be secretary? He thought that meant taking minutes at the meeting. It meant the files of the organization were in the church office. And he did find out that the vacancy that he had filled on the Human Relations Council board had been created by the assassination of Medgar Evers. But Don persisted, quiet guy, but with some unintended visibility on issues of race. And in August of 1965, after a church board meeting, he dropped off one of the board members at his home. Young board member was Johnny Frazier, who was just finishing at Tougaloo College, a historically black college, and hoping to go to seminary in September to prepare for Unitarian Universalist ministry. Don dropped off Johnny Frazier, drove home to his apartment house, and as he got out of his car, another car came into the parking lot and fired two shots. The second, a load of buckshot, caught him in the shoulder, critically wounding him. So he was in the hospital for a long time. And a few weeks later, the director of settlement at the UUA in Boston wrote him a letter. Now for this, I need a minister volunteer back there at the microphone. Do we have a minister in the room who'd be willing to? Yeah, okay, Richard Speck is going to, okay. George Spencer wrote, "Do you think the time is now for you to move to a more comfortable situation or a different climate? I would be pleased to assist you in whatever your plans are." Okay, you're still sitting there in a hospital gown. They've told you that some of the buckshot is so close to your heart, they're not going to try to remove it. It would be more dangerous to remove it than to leave it there. And you're asked, would you like to move? So, 1965, what's a good response, Richard?
Could I have done it yesterday?
Yeah, that's eminently sensible response. Other ministers here, I see several colleagues here. Yeah, yesterday, is that a good response? Yeah. Not what Don Thompson responded. "Thanks for your offer of assistance in placement. If any of the Mississippi congregations feel that my presence is a danger to them, I'll take advantage of your offer. Otherwise, I feel like I ought to try to stay here for the next 7 or 8 years. I should live so long. I realize that the same Knight Riders may be out to finish the job, but why have a successor who would also be a target? The Klan probably is quite upset because, for once, their execution didn't take. Maybe they'll do something about it. Yet, one cannot live on the basis of fear." So, thank you, Richard. That's the sort of spirit that Southern Unitarian Universalists brought to this. And there are many, many other examples, many of them in the book. Some of them, let me give one more. Let me give one more. Let's assume you are a couple, professional people, living in the town that you grew up in. You know the place. One of your children, your youngest daughter, has a disability that really would benefit greatly, hugely, by being in the school in your town that services kids with this particular disabling condition. So the obvious solution is you move to a house that's in the district for that school. Joker here is, this is a black couple. The school is in a white neighborhood. What did John and Joan Cashin in Huntsville, Alabama do? Well, they spent a year or two scouting around for the kind of house that they really wanted in that school district. And they looked at several, or tried to look at several. Always blocked. And realistically, in the early 1960s, that sort of thing could have happened anywhere in the country. It happened in the North, too. But this was Alabama. For sure it happened there. John Cashin was a very successful dentist, so it wasn't a matter of finances. A friend of theirs in the Huntsville Fellowship, another Huntsville member, purchased the house. They provided the money. Sass went and bought the house and immediately transferred the title to the Cashins. Sometimes you have to be sneaky. So, those are a few of the stories, just scratching the surface. One more story before I pull in Hope and David. It's told by Mark Morrison Reed in The Selma Awakening, and I tell a version of it too in Southern Witness. I'd say both of those are books that you should read. Almost all of us are aware of Bloody Sunday, the Sunday in March of 1965 when state highway patrolmen and sheriff's deputies assaulted black Selma residents and residents from surrounding communities who were attempting to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. The Saturday before Bloody Sunday, there was a march in Selma led by one of my heroes, Joseph Ellwanger. Joseph Ellwanger was a white Lutheran minister. Part of his growing up years were spent in Selma. His parents were still living in Selma. Joe Ellwanger was serving as minister of a black Lutheran congregation in Birmingham. The congregation in Birmingham that Chris McNair belonged to, whose daughter was one of the victims in the 16th Street Church bombing in Birmingham. Joe Ellwanger felt it wasn't right that it was only black Alabama residents on the line in support of expanded voting rights. So he organized what he called Concerned White Citizens of Alabama. On that Saturday, 72 concerned white citizens of Alabama marched from the Reformed Presbyterian Church several blocks to the Dallas County Courthouse and read a statement in support of black voting rights. And then attempted to sing America, they were drowned out by a huge, hostile white crowd singing Dixie, with a counterpoint of a supportive black crowd singing We Shall Overcome. But the thing that's one of the things that strikes me about the concerned white citizens of Alabama, 36 out of the 72 were Unitarian Universalists. I didn't know we had 50% of the white population of Alabama. So those are some of the tales of Southern Unitarian Universalists facing the Deep South's reaction. And sadly, last week we saw a late manifestation of the no way. But they found a way out of no way. But I think it's very important that we hear these stories with the spirit of Sankofa. Not just looking back, certainly not looking back and taking credit for what our co-religionists did 40, 50, 60 years ago. We didn't do it, they did it. Looking back and seeing what we can learn from what they did. So, I would like for the Reverend Dr. Hope Johnson, who has been our leader in the Living Legacy Project, to talk a bit about her perspective as president of Living Legacy Project and also as a parish minister, ministering to a congregation on Long Island. Drawing from this history, what do you see doing? And then also hear from David.
Thank you, Gordon. Give it up for Gordon. Let me just start with a reading that my colleague John and Lou Johnstone wrote. And in your mind, you might hum along, We Shall Overcome. It played out, but you know there's something in the message. When we can truly celebrate the diversity of contributions and talents offered by all people, we shall overcome hatred and prejudice and oppression. When we can truly extend our hands to one another in loving acceptance, we shall overcome the past that haunts us now. Living in peace and freedom, we shall overcome the wrongs that have happened and the debts left unpaid. So let us join together in that commitment to overcome as we say together, Amen.
Amen.
So I took a tour through the South following the route of the civil rights movement. Now I'm from the nation Jamaica in the Caribbean. I have lived literally all over the world. I started flying when I was 2 weeks old, so, you know, I had a family that worked all over, and so I kind of knew the world. I was reading in a little journal or something, or maybe it was a World Magazine, about this tour through the civil rights sites. I said, well, that's not exactly on my bucket list, but since I've never been there and I have a little time and I have a little money, let me check it out. So I flew from New York to Chicago, and I met Reverend Dr. Gordon Gibson and his wife, Judy, who's in the house. And just put your hand up, Judy, because she's part and parcel of the whole thing. Together, they work real hard. And I found myself on this bus journeying all the way through from Chicago to the South. And I'm thinking, what am I doing? Why am I on this bus? Why didn't I go someplace fun? You know, they probably won't even have anything to drink there. I don't know. But there I was. I went. And it was, when we use the word transformational, we use it so often that sometimes it's not really transformational. It was the most transformational experience I've had through traveling in my entire life. I finally understood so much about myself and my relationship to the world. Coming from Jamaica, living in a family that kind of got around a bit, I remember being at my home congregation and somebody posed the question, who in this room is privileged? Wouldn't you know, my hand shot up. Because of the life that I had led, I saw myself as privileged. I understood racism. I had been turned away by so many persons, but when I pulled out the diplomatic passport or the this or the that, I had an entry point that made the way clear for me. I still understood racism, but I knew I was privileged because I could speak several languages, my life, this, the other, boom, boom, boom. Going to the South, I got it. I often said, what was wrong with these people? Why didn't they fight harder? Why didn't they kick back? They had the power. Well, we didn't. The things were structured so that there was no possibility of getting out from under in most cases. I finally understood, as a Jamaican, some of the little interpersonal stuff with people who looked just like me. Oh, you came over to take our jobs, all of that stuff. I got so much by going on my first journey. At the end of it all, I said, Gordon and Judy, we have to get all of my friends to come because everybody needs to see this. My whole congregation has to come. Well, we're kind of tired. We've been doing this for a long time, And three of us ganged up against them and said, you have to do it again because you need to teach us what we need to learn so that we can take the work and move it forward. And thus, the Living Legacy Project was born, and we started calling the, we went from tour to journey to pilgrimage. And so that is something that is ongoing, and I invite you to look us up. It's just a wonderful thing that we do. So I've always been a little bit radical. I got involved in aspects of the movement. I remember once storming into my father's office and saying, what have you done for the people, Dad? And he said, get out of my office. You know, I've had moments in my life really fascinating. I have to jump forward now because I am the bridge between Gordon and David. I have a daughter. Her name is Jova. She does amazing work. She's now 26 years old. She calls me up not too long ago and she says, Mom, no, she texts me, Mom, no matter what happens, I love you. All right, can you say a little more? Mom, I don't have time right now, but just know that I love you and everything's going to be okay. Jova, if you don't pick up the phone and call me right now, I'm going to disconnect your phone service and it will not be put back on. Mom, Jova, what are you doing? Mom, it's a long story. Mom, we are shutting down the Oakland police. Black Lives Matter. I said, Joe, are you kidding me? Mom, I gotta go. And in that moment, I moved from all that I had told my daughter. You have to get out there. You have to fight. You have to struggle. to me being just plain old mom scared to death that this kid is going to be incarcerated for the rest of her life. And I said, with my hands trembling, "Hey, Jova, call me when it's over and just tell me you're okay." I was a wreck. I called my friend Michael Salwasser, who's on the UUA Board of Trustees, and I said, "Michael, I don't know what to do." He said, "Hope, my son and his girlfriend are there too. Let's just hope that they'll all be okay." So that's the kind of thing. And when it was over, I said, "Jova, what were you thinking?" She said, "Mom, I knew it would be okay. You taught me to be a strategist." I said, "Really?" She said, "Yes, Mom. They did their research and knew that there was a set of doors that were locked, that were always locked. You can do certain things in front of certain kinds of buildings as long as a door is not used for people coming in and going out." So they knew that they couldn't be arrested for a lot that I thought that they would have been arrested for, because they had done their homework. And Jova said, "Mom, you taught me so much about strategizing and organizing. I'm a chip off the old block." Well, I say that to say that as difficult as it is, and it is difficult for me, I look at Gordon, I look at David. I am so inspired by the things that they do every day. And then I challenge myself, "Well, Hope, what are you prepared to do? Especially now that you know so much more than you did before." And my answer is, I'll do the best I can. I do try to be conscious of what I am doing. And when I just came up and greeted David, I said, "David, thank you so much for all that you're doing. I personally don't care to be arrested, but I'll be there to support those who do." So I'm honest about that. We have to know our limitations. There's too much at stake if I get arrested. So you need to know what to do, organize yourself, use the lessons from the past, that's Sankofa, so that we can all move forward and change this world together. Thank you.
The Reverend David Carl Olson from Baltimore.
Thank you, Gordon. I took a couple notes for myself, and I want to try to stay to them. Now, where are my keys? Here, there. Good. But first thing I want to just say, greetings from Baltimore. It's a it's always interesting to be at a history conference, and then to go back to my place, which loves to be saturated in its sense of history in a way that drives me nuts, because I know Mr. Channing occupied that pulpit for a good 110 minutes and said some important things, and the document that came out of that was the second most widely distributed philosophical document before 1840 in our country, very important. But some things have happened since then, and we probably need to pay attention to those. Well, we decided, building on our love for history, that last year would be our Selma at 50 year. And we planned a series of events, and we started with a beautiful classical music concert in collaboration with the opera department of Morgan State University, a historically black college in Baltimore. We brought Mark Morrison Reed in to be with us, and while that was going to kind of be the centerpiece of the year, it actually got moved to March just because of his travel schedule, which made the March moment huge, because we had scheduled Charles Blackburn to preach before the Selma anniversary, and me to preach after the Selma anniversary, with an expectation that Reverend Blackburn and I would go to Selma together. Interestingly, Charles Blackburn, who served the UU Church in Huntsville, Alabama from 64 to 66, had gone on a Living Legacy pilgrimage and decided he didn't need to go back. It was so emotional for him. And because he went with his partner, co-plaintiff in the argument against the Maryland government for our inability to for the two men to get a marriage license. It was a binding time for them to go together. There was a piece of Charles that Glenn had never seen before. And he said he couldn't go again. He just couldn't re-experience those days. But he asked me to go, and I did. And it was a rich time, overwhelming time. And then we're prepared to conclude the Selma year with a weekend of our celebration of the Channing sermon. We're on Friday night. We were going to do Baltimore Adore, a dialogue on race and ethnicity, which is a growing conversation in our city. On Saturday, a service project where our congregation is in relationship with a community of women coming out of recovery and homelessness and their children, and we're building a garden together and have been doing this for a couple of years. And then on Sunday, in the morning, our spring festival, in the afternoon, our commemoration of the Channing sermon, and a time for seven congregations to worship together, our choirs sing together, a big old thing. And what happens just a week before, well, what happens 2 weeks before, is Freddie Gray dies. Or what happened 3 weeks before, Freddie Gray is fatally injured while being arrested. 2 weeks before, Freddie Gray dies. A week before, Freddie Gray is buried. And the next day, Baltimore erupts into some rioting and some fires. And what do we do? And that was the question. And of course, what we do is we show up. It's interesting to talk about showing up, because the places we already had relationships were as confused as any of us about what to do. The school where we do mentoring was shut down. Mayor shut down the city. The shelter and transitional housing program where we have a relationship, they were closed in on themselves, didn't know where we might be. The congregation-based community organization that we work with, we do long-term stuff. And this just blew up around us. And so being as in touch as we could, largely through social media, we found places. We opened up our church. We opened up our church to meditation and prayer. We had members of our congregation who wanted to just come and play music and be with one another. We opened up our parish hall to be a place to receive volunteers, and then we tried to send them to places where people we knew were doing things. And so, for example, we served thousands of bag lunches because the schools were shut down, and so all these kids who got their meals every day at school suddenly were about to be without their lunch, and for many of these kids, that's the biggest meal of the day. And so only a few dozens, but members of our congregation were sent to the Methodist churches in West Baltimore and East Baltimore. Methodists, by the way, are very connectional. And so when the call came out, they're both connectional and hierarchical. So when the bishop and the district superintendent say, jump into action, they know how to do that. And happily, we have enough relationships with them that we could jump in. And so that was a great thing. But the meaning of showing up also meant this thing that we're not comfortable with. We like to be in charge, right? I like to be in charge. Let's make it more personal. I like to know how things are going. I like to be part of making the decision. And to show up and to say, I don't know, right? And to show up and say, please tell me what you need, is an uncomfortable situation. And especially because the most active people were a younger generation than my congregation is connected to. Now, my congregation includes a good number of young adults. There are all kinds of people who come to Baltimore for 2, 3, 4 years to do their graduate stuff at Johns Hopkins or some other place. They come to church, it's wonderful, but in terms of long-term lasting community relationships, those largely reside with the older generation of our church. And the older generation of our church is mostly connected to service organizations rather than to on-the-grounds organizing networks. And so we were learning in that moment. And the fact that the UUA gave us a tiny grant it took probably 48 hours, but very quickly was helpful to allow me to hire someone to come and help out. And also we had very good relations with the UUSJ, which is the Social Justice Movement for the National Capital Region, and the UU Legislative Ministry in Maryland, on whose board I sit. There were staff people from other organizations who came to be with us and help us. So that was a really great thing. I want to just say one word about social media, and the positive thing is if one were following people's Twitter feed or people's Facebook feeds or things like that, you could discover all kinds of things that were happening in Baltimore, all kinds of places to make to respond and make a difference. Now understand, the violence happened for 12 hours, right? It was from late afternoon on Monday, the day that Freddie Gray was buried, and it was until the middle of the night between Monday and Tuesday. By Tuesday, the city was on shutdown. We had imposed curfew. The National Guard was present. I mean, it was a military occupation in some ways. I was not under martial law because the guard was taking their direction from the city police. But it was there was an evening curfew that was quite severe and was imposed throughout the city. But the violence had ended, and the rebuilding was happening. So lots of the actual involvement that we had was in the rebuilding, although there were days of protests about the police. And the thing, I think, that made things change for Baltimore in a way that was different than what happened in Ferguson, and we were in conversation both with congregational organizations and with congregations in Ferguson, was that on the Friday after Freddie Gray's death and the Friday after the Monday night riots, that the state's attorney issued her indictments and indicted all six police officers, including a second-degree murder charge. That, while that did create ire on the part of the police department, largely it meant that demonstrations turned into celebrations. Now, what's going to be happening over the rest of the summer, we don't know. The defense of the police is doing a huge media campaign, trying to get the venue changed, trying to get the state's attorney to recuse herself, trying to turn public opinion against Freddie Gray. So there's a little powder keg still sitting there that we may have to pay attention to. But it means that right now what we have to be doing is to be doing relational work. And I want to just say that because when we think about this as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, it becomes complicated when, for many of us, we want to say, well, doesn't our first principle say that all lives matter? And of course it does. Of course it does. But the fact of the matter is, at this moment, there's a place we have to pay attention. Once upon a time, and I'm a gay man, gay men were dying of AIDS, and our churches said that these gay bodies mattered. It was important. We didn't say that other people's bodies didn't matter. Give me a break. Once upon a time, we said that lesbian couples and gay male couples should get a chance to marry one another, right? We didn't say that other marriages were any less valid. Give me a break. And the fact of the matter, we're saying today, Black Lives Matter, because this is about the liberation of all of us. And I just want to say that when we talk to people in the Black Lives Matter movement, a movement that was started by queer black women, we are talking about a movement that says it is a sustainable movement, which means that sometimes you go to a colleague who's overworking, and you don't just say, oh, learn to say no. Oh, give me. You say, what's the work you're doing? I will do the work for you. Take a day off. I'm tired of being, by the way, don't tell me to learn to say no, all right? I'm tired of it, okay? But the sustainable movement doesn't just say, I'm going to put it back on you that you're overperforming. I'm going to say, we're going to perform better. If you show me what you're doing, let me do it, and maybe you can go to the beach, all right? It says that it's a holistic movement. It's not just about the relationship between a people and the police. It's not just about the economic system. It's not just about, it's about the whole of us and the whole communities we want to live in. And it is a spiritual movement. Yes. And so when people go to demonstrations and show up with readings that inspire us, that show up with sage to purify the places we are, that find ways to pray together, to be together. For me, to be with a group of clergy who go down to their knees in the middle of an intersection and say, this world must stop and pay attention, because the change that has to happen is a huge change. And when I talk with people in my congregation, and you know that I love them, and you know that they love me, but people say, just can we get back to normal? And I say, what have we been organizing about before Freddie Gray? The old normal was unacceptable then. We are not going to return to the old normal. And I do want to say to the pastors in the house that this is a time, yes, this is a time for the prophetic, but it's a time for the pastoral. I can't tell you how many people in my congregation have asked to talk to me about wondering whether there's a future for them in Unitarian Universalism, because they sit in the pew and someone says, but all lives matter. Okay, now, I'm sorry, I don't mean to ridicule anybody, but that was the ridiculous thing I had to say. To not know the pain that our words and our presence can bring to people means that I, as a pastor, get a chance to sit with the person who said all lives matter and say, let's talk about that. And to sit with the person who says, I don't know if there's a place for me in Unitarian Universalism anymore, and to say, let's talk about that. I will tell you that there was a moment in our spring celebration where several black folk walked out. Now, they didn't walk out to look like they were walking out, because, of course, we wouldn't do that. We are such a polite people. But it was as if Freddie Gray had not died. It was as if the riot had not broken out. We had this spring celebration. And yes, there were people who made a little reference to it here and a little reference to it there, but they actually described it as if they had thrown out their whole script and came back just to be. And that was so not true. And they were acting as if we kind of got over this little event. And there were people who walked out and only came in again because I instructed the ushers to escort into this arbor that I had created this amount of time, our Black Lives Matter banner, which, by the way, is 4 feet tall and 6 feet wide. It's perfect size to carry at the front of a demonstration, but it's got to be bold, right? And when that came in, and I'm remembering one person in particular who stood there and began to weep, and who said, "Since last Monday, I have been unable to cry." And finally, this was the moment. I was in my spiritual home. I was seeing this particular message that spoke to me. And I was able to affirm whatever spring meant and all that stuff. But mostly, I was able to say that my life matters, and to see people singing back to me as if my life mattered too. And so the pastoral concern is, to me, the thing that some of us, and maybe all of us, because I don't believe pastoral work is just the work of the guy who's paid up front, right? We have to create communities of pastoral care. And so that pastoral work is so important to do right now, because change is not easy. And change is essential if we're going to be the Unitarian Universalist movement that we proclaim. Thanks.
Oh. Yeah. Because this is about all of us, it is about a community, I'd like to give you all the opportunity to ask any of the three of us questions or offer your own observations. While we're waiting for somebody to get to the microphone, let me follow on what David said. One of the suggestions I make toward the end of the book is that what enabled people, and in some cases entire congregations, to act, to work toward that way out of no way, was that there was that community that could nurture and support and gently critique and help them go back out and try again and accumulate more experience and then have some place to return to where they were understood, where they were accepted for who they were and what they were attempting. It's really, really important that we have these communities of faith to nurture and support, and yeah, we don't do it perfectly, but it's important to try. Yes?
Hi, I'm, is this on?
Yeah. Yes.
I'm Rick Rhodes from UU in Santa Monica, California. I just wanted to comment on what David, right, yes, said about the violence only lasted 12 hours. I assume you're talking about the people in the streets. Actually, the violence had lasted for many years.
Yes.
From the police and from society in general, doing very violent things to people's health, to people's education, to people, making people unemployed, doing things that essentially kill family members. And actually, the violence didn't amount to much. I mean, I don't think they killed anybody, right? So it also seems to me that that violence was, so-called violence, was intimately connected with the indictments. I don't think there would have been any indictments to this day if it hadn't been for people rebelling in the streets. That's all.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Claudia Cohen. I'm from the Unitarian Church in Summit, New Jersey. Thank all three of you. It was a wonderful combination of experiences and voices. And I was moved to just share a little bit. We've been following the Beloved Conversations curriculum for the last couple of years, and I've had the privilege of facilitating it this year. And it was disappointingly difficult to get a lot of attention in our congregation, despite what I think is in people's hearts. But, you know, there's the building project, and we're losing members, you know, everything. And in our town, there was the interfaith ministers and some people who've done a lot of work on dialogue and interfaith and interracial dialogue created dialogue circles on race, and I've been one of the facilitators. And I've had a whole new sense of inspiration and energy from working with other faiths.
Yes.
And I heard that mentioned this morning, the multi-faith or interfaith work. And I'm just wondering if you, I think I heard that, David, in your conversation too. It just makes so much sense. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that, how to make it work, or any experiences that you would share.
So let me just say that there is this interesting truth that the traditional congregation-based community organizing networks tend to be tend to have congregations that are a little more, if you will, establishment. It's hard to say that. And so we were all caught unawares by what happened, and the question of how to respond was a question that we shared. Still, the PICO National Network, for example, has just announced that it is their aim in the next 6 months to train enough people to do one-to-one relational conversations with 2 million young adults and youth at risk, and the organizations that serve them, the people in the organizations that serve them. But for them to set up this goal for themselves, to say that being intimately connected to the people whose lives are most affected by the prison industrial complex, et cetera, that this is a really exciting time. I will also tell you, and this is interesting, I was at a clergy meeting a couple weeks ago where someone said, are there any recording devices? Please make sure that all recording devices are turned off. I know this is being recorded, so it's funny as I say this. And one of the clergy wanted to say, if we really wanted to do direct action that somebody would notice, how can we screw up the economic business as usual? What would it look like if 200 clergy drove their cars together on 95 right outside of Baltimore Harbor, Baltimore Port, and parked their cars and went to pray? What would it be like in the middle of this 95, the highway of the Atlantic seaboard, for us to just screw it up? And these were not the radicals. These are just, they would describe themselves as country preachers, right? But colleagues who are so daring, and I don't know that that's going to happen. And if it does happen, you didn't hear it here. No one recorded it. And you're not part of a conspiracy. But there is a boldness that is connected to their sense of complicity. Because they say, why did my church lose that generation? Why did I, in my comfort, refuse to see the truth of the lives that people live? How is it that I've allowed the wage divide, the wealth divide, to grow to the point that it's like it was in the 1920s? And so for people to say it's not just them that are the problem, but that we, in our complicity, in our inability to find an alternative way, in our willingness to go with this, that we haven't put up the obstacles to this, to oppression, and have not opened the doors to liberation. Anyway, I think interfaith dialogue is rich. In Baltimore, there's a white area up and down Charles Street, and that's where my people live. And we were not affected by the fires. We were not affected by the closing of shops. We were even not affected by the looting of pharmacies, and especially the looting of pharmacies that has now led to this influx of prescription drugs on street corners in Baltimore that has now led to turf wars, that has now led to more murders since Freddie Gray's death than we've had before, because the police now, because of the indictments, are backing off and kind of working to contract and things like that. So we have this volatile situation, and it's going to take all of us to address it properly.
I think we have started a conversation that could go for considerably longer, but the clock says, two things ere we leave. There are Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society membership forms. There are also a few extra pins left over from the Selma 50-year celebration. If you would like to pick up one of the pins in the shape of the bridge, a shape reminiscent of that bridge, that infamous bridge in Selma, feel free. I'll be picking them up in a couple of minutes. See you downstairs. Some books.
Yes.
Yes.
And just for everyone, just before you go, can I tell you, in terms of history, living history, Congressman John Lewis is going to be joining us on Saturday, and he's the one that reminds us to get in the way. So Saturday at 6:15 p.m. in the Portland Ballroom or something, he will be there. John Lewis. Yes.
How you doing? Sorry,
John
about
Lewis.
John Lewis.
Service Committee.
Yes. This idea of leaders as followers. Now that is something we got to take back.
Yes. Simple and yet profound.
Thank you.
Ha ha ha.